Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you on Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you listen to the program, you know what it's all about. It's about honoring veterans for their service and the sacrifices that they've made to ensure the freedom that we enjoy in this country every day. It's also about preserving their stories so they're not forgotten, that they'll be held on to for years to come, preserved for posterity. And really, the third mission of this show is to inspire the rest of us when we hear these stories of our soldiers, so many of them from the greatest generation, that we'll be inspired to love our country the way they love the United States of America, to be willing to put others before ourselves, and to live up to that legacy that the greatest generation has given us. You know that today is June 5th. That means tomorrow is June 6th, and that is the 66th anniversary of D-Day, the start of Operation Overlord and the invasion of the European continent during World War II. I've been a busy bee lately. If you were watching ABC last night, as I hope you were, you saw the Scripps National Spelling Bee, which I had the privilege of announcing again this year on television. So I've been traveling a lot, been all over the place. Usually when I make it to Washington, D.C. for that event, I'm able to catch up with veterans at the World War II Memorial, one of my favorite places in the whole world. I wasn't able to do that this time because my schedule was so tight, but we're going to listen to some of those past interviews from veterans at the World War II Memorial, so many of them who made it there because of an organization called Honor Flight. We're also going to hear from a Valley veteran who participated in the D-Day invasion and will soon be making one of those honor flights to the World War II Memorial. But to start things off today, I thought I would take you back to June 6, 1944, in a very real way to hear from the voices of some very significant Americans what was said that day on radios all over this country. And if you were alive back then, something maybe you even remember. First, we're going to hear what General Dwight David Eisenhower had to say to the Allied troops preparing to make that invasion of Europe. Here's General Eisenhower on June 6, 1944.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
So that was General Dwight Eisenhower addressing the troops, but the Commander-in-Chief also had something to say that day, June 6, 1944. Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation, the president asking Americans everywhere to unite in prayer. And as you listen to this speech, this prayer by the President of the United States, maybe ask yourself if we would hear something similar today or even in the last few decades. And for those of you who, like me, were not born yet in June of 1944, maybe this will give you a glimpse of how all-consuming, how incredibly crucial the mission was then, and how united the people of our United States were at that moment in history. Here is President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on June 6, 1944.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too. Strengthen our daily tasks. To redouble the contributions we make in the physical and the material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout. To wait out the long travel. To bear sorrows that may come. To impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace. A peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
So that was President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on June 6, 1944, 66 years ago tomorrow. And I've got one more little flashback for you. It wasn't just generals addressing troops and a president addressing a nation. It was anywhere you turned. You're hearing my voice this afternoon because of the magic of radio, which was the most powerful and pervasive medium of the day in 1944. So much of what Americans learned about the war, they heard it on the radio. And so many of the messages that helped inspire and unite Americans at that time were sent out over the airwaves, like this very station, KMJ. Let's go back again to June 6, 1944, to hear from one of the most prominent and admired radio stars of the day.
It's high noon in New York and time for Kate Smith, who will be brought to you every Tuesday and Thursday during the summer by the makers of Sure Gel, America's fastest-selling powdered pectin product. Here she is, Kate Smith.
Hello, everybody. Today is a day that no living American can ever forget, Invasion Day, forged into our consciousness in letters of fire. It marks the pinnacle of weeks and months and years of anguished preparation, the consolidating of our mighty forces. This is the hour of the death blow to those, our enemies, who have spread evil, sorrow, and suffering like a black shadow across the face of this earth. This is the day of reckoning, when America and her allies go forward to the terrible task of crushing completely and forever the enemies who for 4.5 years have ravaged one helpless nation after another. This is the day that must mark the beginning of the downfall of Nazi Germany and the downfall of all those who have sanctioned and aided the brief reign of terror, the cruelty, insanity, and arrogance of Hitlerism. Let the blow be swift and sure. Let us be strong and unswerving in purpose, strong in the assurance that we go forward in a cause which is right, in the liberation of the oppressed and the restoration of human decency and dignity from the forces of evil. This is Invasion Day, Liberation Day. Here at home, we sit beside our radios, eagerly hanging on each word of news that flashes across an ocean around the world. We're filled with a conflict of many emotions, fear, excitement, and hope. But these emotions will not help those whom we most desire to help. They will not carry our brave fighting forces forward unless we harness those thoughts and guide them and use their power to forge an invincible weapon against the foe. Today, we cannot afford to stand idly by, scattering our thoughts so haphazardly that they reap only the wind. We must concentrate them on victory and turn our earnest, united thoughts into devout, unceasing prayer to God. Wherever you are at this moment, whatever you are doing, join your prayers with mine. A prayer for victory. Pray that our crusaders may be strong, that success will crown their every effort. Pray that they may speedily accomplish their mission and bring their adversaries to unconditional surrender. Pray to our Father in heaven to look down with compassion upon this sick and sorrowing world and guide the forces of right against the forces of evil and insanity. If millions of us, every man, woman, and child in America, will lift our fervent prayers to God, those prayers will be answered. You all know the power of faith and prayer. Use that power now. Use it with every fiber of your heart and soul and mind so that your prayers, along with mine, may reach outward and upward to to encompass and aid those we love and the cause for which they crusade. Lift up your prayers for victory and for peace to him who said, "Ask, and ye shall receive." And now, Ted, what's new?
Allied invasion forces are storming ashore along northern France this noon, taking the first long step to Berlin from a bridge of ships stretching across the English Channel. And the most important news of the hour, in the words of Prime Minister Churchill, is that operations are proceeding according to plan. Never before in history has the world seen anything like the invasion armada that stands between England and France and fills the skies above. 11,000 planes, 4,000 ships, and thousands of smaller craft are in action. And when the invasion was only hours old, the good news came through that we have seized beachheads which threaten the whole Normandy Peninsula and a rail line that runs right into Paris. The British radio says that we have a firm grip on two beachheads and that Allied formations are advancing inland possibly as much as 10 miles. Meantime, the German DNB news agency has admitted dolefully that American tanks have been put ashore in at least one sector. D-Day and H-Hour arrived between the hours of 6 and 8:15 a.m. Western European time, which is between midnight and 2:15 Eastern wartime here in the United States. It was at that hour that land forces under command of General Montgomery began moving ashore along the Normandy coast in the Le Havre-Cherbourg area. As a prelude, the Royal Air Force staged a shattering 1,300 plane attack, and naval guns poured their heavy fire against Nazi strong points. A short time later, great forces of our airborne troops began dropping out of planes behind the enemy lines. In a speech to the House of Commons, Prime Minister Churchill declared, "Obstacles which were constructed in the sea have not proved so difficult as it was apprehended. The fire of the shore batteries has been largely quelled. Mass airborne landings have been successfully effected behind enemy lines, and landings on the beaches are proceeding at various points at the present time." Mr. Churchill, once more resuming the role of a war reporter, told members that he couldn't concentrate on any particular details, and the reason was the reports were coming in much too fast. He said, however, that operations are proceeding according to plan, and then he added, "What a plan."
The news continued on from there, of course, and you know what happened from there. When Hometown Heroes returns after this break, we'll hear from a local veteran about his experiences on June 6th, 1944. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
I couldn't give you Kate Smith's voice today without letting you hear a little bit of her singing God Bless America. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Tomorrow marks the 66th anniversary of the Normandy invasion. I've already taken you back to June 6, 1944 through the voices of General Eisenhower, President Roosevelt, and of course Kate Smith. But now we'll do it with someone a little closer to home, someone who also has been called Mr. President. He is the President Emeritus of Fresno City College, Clyde McCauley, who as a coxswain on an LCVP landed troops in some of the most famous invasions of World War II, both in Europe and in the Pacific. His first such experience came on June 6, 1944 at Utah Beach. And you'll hear his experiences there after he first tells us how he ended up in the United States Coast Guard.
I grew up in Florida, and I had knowledge of the Coast Guard and what the Coast Guard did because I spent a certain amount of time at the beaches and in different cities where the Coast Guard was well represented. You saw a lot of their units on the beach and at sea there. But one reason that I knew it perhaps a little better was that I was a Sea Scout when I was a kid growing up, and the Sea Scouts at that time got a lot of instruction and help from the Coast Guard personnel located near to us.
When you signed up with the Coast Guard, did you know what an LCVP was?
Not really. As a matter of fact, when I signed up for the Coast Guard, I had the vague notion that when you told them what you'd like to do, if you joined, you might get a chance to do it. Well, the fact was that I really wanted to be a quartermaster and learn a lot more about communications and navigation. And they said, you might get a chance to do that. And that really made me enthusiastic. And immediately after I got out of boot camp, I ended up at Camp Lejeune with the Marines training for invasions.
Which I'm sure was just the welcome news to you.
Well, they kept me busy enough to cause me not to worry too much about what I wasn't getting.
Yeah, no time for that. With landing troops, and you did it at Normandy, as we said, at southern France, at Iwo Jima, at Okinawa, what is that like emotionally? Because we've all seen the pictures, especially at DD, of these LCVPs. And for those of you who don't know, those are the landing craft, the Higgins boats that were taking troops to the shore, dropping them off. And I know you've spoken to classes before and have told people what you did. And some of the teenagers who don't quite understand will say, you mean you dropped them off and then you left? What kind of soldier are you? But what was that like for you as 18 years old to see these other guys the same age as you and knowing what they were going to face when they hit that
sand? Well, that question did come up in one or two of the classes that I visited. But I think what's important to realize is that if you're coxswain of one of those boats, the important thing is not only getting where you want to be on the beach or close to the beach, it's getting your boat out of that situation and back to do some further work. So you're so consumed by trying to follow through with all of what your task happens to be that you don't really have an opportunity to get too involved with the heartstrings about what the other people are supposed to be doing. So they go their way, and then I would go my way. And I think high school students would wonder, don't you really stop and think about what this may mean to these fellows who are being left on the beach? And in a way you do, because you know they're now there and they have to be supported. And that means getting back and getting some more people there if you can.
Well, in your first trip, landing troops on a beach, you definitely didn't have time to think about that because that didn't exactly go as planned. Tell our listeners about what happened at Utah Beach on June 6, 1944.
Well, what happened was that I took a special assignment into the into Utah Beach, and on that assignment, I ran into a barge that was sunken, that had been sunken on the beach, near the beach. And so I ended up flying out of the coxswain's placement and into the front of the boat about 25 or 30 feet. And so I was unconscious during that particular part of it. And my motor mech at that time took the boat after he disengaged it from the barge, took it back to the ship, and they took me back aboard. And I didn't know that was all going on, but I woke up in the sick bay, and someone was running a needle up my foot to see if I was reacting. And so that's when I came to again, and they sent me back to work.
Yeah, no time to sit there and think about it. We need you out there. Did you remember what had happened, or did it take a while for...
No, not very much. I know that the impact occurred, and I can remember just flying out of the cockpit toward the front of the boat and hitting the deck and then waking up in the sick bay.
Did any of...
not a very heroic sort of act.
Well, and not exactly an encouraging first trip, I suppose,
no,
if you know
true.
That you're going to be doing this again.
Yeah.
But as fate would have it, you had plenty more opportunities to participate in invasions, and I want to get to that. But while we're on Normandy, when was it that you did realize the magnitude of that day? I know you had seen all the ships, and that had to be just mind-blowing to see the grandeur of the invasion force there. But when was it that you realized, in hindsight, this was a really historic, significant thing that I was a part of?
That didn't really come to me until years later. And years later, I had the opportunity to go to Normandy and take a look at what they had done to reconstruct, create the museum there and reconstruct the scene in model form. And Dave was with me. So we did get together
He needed some geography.
Yes, he had a little opportunity for more geography there, and so we had a chance to go through that. And in going through the museum there, which is a magnificent reconstruction of just exactly how long, how much planning went into that, and how long it took to pull together all the pieces that were necessary to make that invasion work. And it, so as an 18-year-old driving a boat, someone used to say when they'd learned that I was at Normandy, what was it like? Well, it was like a truck, and you were told to take this load from this point to the next point and deliver it if you can. And so that's about what I knew about it, just knowing the job. But after I had a chance to see all that went into it, I think that's when I really had a fair sense of exactly what happened there.
So that was Dr. Clyde McCauley about his experiences on June 6, 1944, just the tip of the iceberg of what he did during World War II. But when we come back, we'll talk to some veterans who have experienced something Clyde is about to experience. He is going to make a flight with Honor Flight to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., and I've had a chance to visit with several veterans who have done just that. When we come back, we'll hear from some veterans from South Carolina who participated in that program. You're listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm so excited that our last guest that you just heard from, Clyde McCauley, gets to participate in that Honor Flight program that takes veterans to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. free of charge and really gives them the royal treatment while they're there. I look forward to hearing about it from Clyde when he gets back. And I've had the privilege on numerous occasions to visit that spectacular World War II Memorial and talk to veterans who were there with Honor Flight to hear how much it meant to them and to also get a taste of their experiences during the war. So let's listen to one of those interviews now with a gentleman from South Carolina by the name of Chevis Ward. Well, Chevis, first of all, where are you from?
Charleston, South Carolina.
And you came here with Honor Flight with a big right. group of fellow veterans. How much fun was that for you?
It's very, very impressive. Very impressive.
This is your first time to the memorial?
Yes, to this memorial. I have been to Washington before, but not since this was built.
When you, I'm sure you've seen pictures of it and everything, but when you actually got here and got off the bus and started to walk around and look at it, what kind of thoughts went through your head? What did it mean to you?
Well, it meant a great deal to me because I spent my whole tour of duty almost in the South Pacific or later on in the upper Pacific, you know, from the Philippines on up to Okinawa. And for the first time, I think I've after the war was over and elections were held, I voted for Harry Truman, a Democrat, which I had never done. But I loved him because he saved my life.
By dropping the bombs, he saved your life?
By dropping the bomb. Because we had picked up troops in the Philippines and were on the way back to Okinawa to regroup and go into Japan, and that was going to be bad. And about 2 days before we got to Okinawa, back to Buckner Bay, he dropped the first bomb and then later dropped the second bomb, and that pretty much ended it for us. We were very happy, and that's why I voted for him. He saved my life.
and millions others, too. Right. Now, you were 17 when you joined the service?
Yeah.
And from South Carolina?
Yeah.
What you expected, or did you get a wake-up call? Did you have to grow up in a hurry?
Well, I went in before Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. I went in September of 1941, and I was on the battleship Wyoming in the North Atlantic, I think, trying to scare Hitler uh-huh. and his submarine fleet when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor.
How long did it take for you to catch wind of it there in the Atlantic, what had happened in the Pacific?
Well, the fleet knew what was going on, and we made a beeline back to Newport, Rhode Island, so that the country could group itself together and find out what to do. But Roosevelt did a good job.
Did that change things for you when you realized we really are at war? Because you've already been out there at sea, but now the war is on, and things are going to change for you. Did that impact you right away?
At 17 years old, I don't think it did.
Did you stay on the Wyoming through the rest of the war?
No, It was very shortly after that that I got transferred into the amphibious force. And we carried mostly back then Marines in on invasions, like Guadalcanal was the first. I was still 17 when I was on the ship and went in on my first battle.
So you're on an LCM or an LCVP or something like that?
I wasn't building them yet. I was on an old ship that had been pressed into service back in 1940. Mm-hmm. And anyhow, they loaded us up in Norfolk, Virginia, and on April the 10th, 1942, a huge convoy left Norfolk, Virginia for the Panama Canal, and we had Marines on our ship to try to reinforce Manila because the Philippines hadn't fallen yet. And about a day out of Panama, the Philippines fell, so they sent us to British Samoa, and we let those Marines off there, and then they sent us on down to Wellington, New Zealand to wait for the other Marines, the 1st Division Marines, to come into Wellington and be trained up for the Guadalcanal invasion. And so I was in that while I was still 17 years old.
So you're a teenager, and you're dropping off these other teenagers, a lot of them are in their early 20s, to go do battle on these islands. You drop them off, but not that many of them come back. What was that like to experience and to know what you were doing?
It was not pleasant, let me put it that way, because the ship I was on was not what you'd call a warship. We carried troops and supplies to the Marines, and we'd have to come in and unload as fast as we could and get out before the Japs came down to get us.
And I'm sure that you were shot at a time or two, that the Japanese did come after you. Any close calls that stand out in your mind where you thought, I might not be waking up tomorrow?
The first real air raid we had, I was on the top side of the ship, and 44 torpedo bombers came in on the whole fleet. And what scared me was what I call friendly fire. When they came in, they were right at mast height, you know, and there's a lot of steel in the air. And I was standing there in the railing of the ship was right here, and a string of 20 millimeter bullets came by. Every fifth one had was a tracer. I could have reached out and grabbed one. That's how and that was friendly fire.
Now, what do you do in a situation like that? Do you say a prayer? You hold your breath?
Yeah, you got the hell out of the way. I jumped behind a big coil of wire. And I said, no, I better not stay here, because if one of those bullets comes through here, it's going to eat me up.
And I imagine that wasn't the only time that you faced a situation like that.
I got out and ran through the sick bay and came out on the other side. And as soon as I opened the hatch and looked out, there was a Jap plane right out there, and the 20 millimeter gunner, which was right above me up there, was knocking holes in the side of the plane like that. And finally he got the port engine in it, and the plane just veered around like that and fell right in front of us. and we just ran over it. I mean, we couldn't do anything. I mean, he was right. I thought he was going to hit the ship. But we shot down, the fleet shot down all 44 of them.
Wow.
Not a one of them got out the other side.
I can't imagine being in your shoes for a situation like that. Now, you told me about how relieved you were the bombs were dropped. You thanked Harry Truman. You even voted for him for saving your life. When you think about the legacy of the Greatest Generation and all the folks that are with you on this trip and what you want your kids and grandkids and future generations of America to remember about that time in our history, what do you think is the most important thing that people ought to know?
Self-reliance to start with, and have to do what you feel like you really need to do for yourself and for your country.
And did you have a feeling that everybody was in it together?
Yeah, everybody was. About the only time I came back to the States after we left in April of 42, I came back in August of 44, but everybody I knew and everybody I saw were all for the war effort. I mean, all country was all out in favor of getting it solved.
Well, thank you for sharing your stories with me, and thank you for serving our country.
Thank you.
So that was Chevis Ward of South Carolina, and when we come back, we'll hear from another World War II veteran from that part of our country who not only served but suffered a great loss at the very outset of the war. We'll get that story when Hometown Heroes continues next here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll continue now with another veteran who I caught up to at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. A.C. Edwards not only served our country, he did so with great motivation. The very first day of the war, the attacks on Pearl Harbor claimed the life of one of his relatives. We'll get that story from him. Here's my interview with A.C. Edwards. A.C., now where did you grow up?
I grew up in the eastern North Carolina. Goldsboro was my home.
All right. And how did you end up? How did Uncle Sam get a hold of you?
Well, I came along after him. I had the three of us boys, and the oldest one was killed at Pearl Harbor, and the other one was in the CC camps, and he was immediately mobilized in Marine Corps, and by Christmas of 41, he was at Parris Island, and later in the invasion of Guadalcanal and all that. Anyway, I didn't get out of, I was 17 in 1944 and finished high school and joined the Navy.
But your brother was killed on December 7th, 1941? How much did that motivate you to want to serve?
I couldn't wait to get in.
And I can tell it's still emotional for you. But you ended up, was he a Navy man?
Oh, yeah. He was still on the USS West Virginia. No, I couldn't wait. I was afraid the war was going to end before I could get in. So as soon as I got out of high school in 1944, I joined.
Let me ask you about that. I know it's difficult for you to talk about your brother, but do you remember how you heard about Pearl Harbor and how long it was till you found out that your brother had been a victim of that attack?
Well, I was down the street making some model airplanes with some friends, and it came on the radio that Pearl Harbor had been attacked, and I knew he was there, and I ran home. And I guess it was a few weeks before Mother was notified. They just said it was missing in action, and that was it. Then later on we learned that he was given up. He was buried, I think, in Hawaii. And
the punch bowl?
Yeah, and later returned home. But it was quite some time before they told us he was dead.
Have you been out to the Arizona Memorial there? And
oh, yeah. We were anchored. I went, when I was on the ship, we left the States and went to Pearl Harbor in 1944 and anchored right across from where the ships were attacked. In fact, the Arizona was still there and had been stripped down to the water's level, and they just left it there. All the other ships were gone. And the West Virginia, some of those ships were refloated and participated in the battle later on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that an emotional thing for you to be back at Pearl Harbor and realize this is where my brother gave his life for our country?
Yep, it was sort of. But I was 17, uh-huh. Headed over there myself. So.
What does it mean to you to come to this World War II memorial and think about the fact that your brothers and yourself are all honored here?
I've been wanting to come, and we've been planning trips, so we just didn't get here. So it was a great opportunity for me to be here today, and I'm impressed with it. I like the idea that we have it. And, you know, I just heard recently that they're going to build a World War One memorial. Mm-hmm. My dad was in World War One. I didn't know they even have one up here.
And it's too bad that the World War One veterans aren't going to be around to see it, but I know it's special for you to be here. Tell me about what you did in the war. What kind of ship were you on?
Well, we were on a tender, a repair ship, and I guess we were left Mobile, Alabama in the fall of September 44 and went over to Pearl Harbor and on out in the Pacific, and I guess we were marshaling, getting ships ready to invade Okinawa. We went to several spots down there and worked on ships, and then we later went on up to Okinawa with invasion, and that's when the war ended up there. But we were, you know, I guess that was, nobody told me anything. I just did what I was told. But we went to all kinds of different places in the Pacific and worked on different ships. And later I learned that we were getting ships ready for the invasion of Okinawa.
Do you think Okinawa kind of gets forgotten with all the focus on Iwo Jima and some of the other battles in the Pacific? Because, I mean, that was a pretty brutal battle. How much of it did you get to see, or were you off the shore the whole time?
No, I was right there in the harbor, and the Navy stretched a string of picket lines between the Japanese home islands and Okinawa, and those guys were patrolling back and forth and trying to intercept the airplanes before they got to Okinawa. And a lot of them got kamikazes got them, and they came into Okinawa for us to patch up, and some of the kamikazes got through too. And we were at general quarters 100 times, I guess, in 3 months.
So it was pretty much a constant fear that a kamikaze could hit you.
Oh yeah, that we had several ships hit around us and we didn't get hit. We had, at first we shot. Our ship wasn't a warship either, it was a more of a service ship. But anyway, at first the Japanese kamikazes came and we'd shoot at them. And at night they'd follow the tracers down. So we stopped shooting and they laid a smoke screen across the harbor.
So they were actually hoping you would shoot at them so they could find your ship and crash into it.
Yeah, crazy.
And you saw firsthand the damage they could cause when you repaired these other ships.
Yeah,
how devastating was it?
Well, the ships had hit on that picket line particularly and come alongside of us, and our guys would swarm over there and clean the ship up and take off the dead and either patch it up so it could get back to the rear base or get back on the picket line. And of course, every night, the kamikazes were coming in down there too, so see a lot of death. We didn't have it on our ship, but saw a lot of ships hit that were hit.
Did you ever wake up while you're over there thinking, I don't know, this may be it for me, I might not be here tomorrow?
I never thought about that. I was 19 when I got out, so I only served 2 years.
Felt pretty invincible, huh?
I wasn't worried about dying.
When you see this memorial, what does it mean to you? What do you hope that people who weren't in the war like you, people that are younger, you see all the school children that are here, what is it that you hope they get out of this, that they learn?
Well, life isn't just free. You're always under some threat. And you got to come together and fight when you have to fight and protect the country. And that's what our guys are doing in Iraq. That's what the guys did in Vietnam. And they came home and everybody was hissing at them and screaming, yelling, child, yeah, how many kids you killed today and all that crap. And those guys didn't go over there just for the hell of it, you know. They went over there to serve their country. Now, we were different. We came home from World War II and everybody, it was a real united time. You could be proud of the country and they could be proud of you. And Vietnam just made me sick.
There are a lot of Vietnam veterans that are helping World War II veterans here at the memorial, pushing them around and everything. What kind of reception do you get when you're here? How many people have come up and thanked you?
They thank us all the time, you know. Heroes, well, they're not a hero in the whole crowd. At least we don't think so. But they've been very appreciative, very nice, and heartwarming. And this honors flight business is, somebody's working their tail off to put this together, and I really appreciate it, but I didn't know anything about it until he called me.
Other veterans hear about Honor Flight thinking about going, would you tell them absolutely go for it?
Absolutely, yes, sir. They've got a lot of people on the plane helping us, and if anybody needs help, they got help to call on. And I guarantee you, when the buses come at noon, they'll round us up and put us on the bus, and we're going to eat lunch and on the bus and go somewhere else.
You think you ever would have made it out here without Honor Flight?
I haven't so far. So the only reason I'm here is because they brought me here. I've been wanting to come and planning on it, but it just never worked out.
Well, I'm so glad it did work out, and we're out of time on today's program. I'll be back next week with a brand new edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.